Kia ora tātou, Tau Hollander. I'm the chair of the Palmerston North Defence Heritage Advisory Group. This month we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of the battles for Monte Cassino over the period February-March 1944. And our resident expert that you all know, Will Harper, has deigned to give us a presentation following a book, an excellent book that he wrote on the battles. And then after Glyn's presentation, Councillor Mark Arnott, who has passed on apologies from Mayor Grant Smith, who's down in Blenheim on business at the moment. But if anybody you saw him on Facebook, was it this morning?
TVNZ
this morning on the breakfast program talking about vandalism in our city. Then you'll know that he's on the go night and day. Mark's got some items from his family who served in Cassino to show, and I'll leave that over to Mark after Glyn's presentation. So really, without further ado, I would invite Glyn to come and talk to us about the battles of Cassino. Glyn, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much for that introduction. I will be talking about the battles of Monte Cassino, and this is a military history talk, so I cannot do it without referring to some maps on the screen. And I actually brought a pointer along. One of our garden tomatoes is not looking so well, look at it. So I will be talking and referring to the maps, and hopefully you can see the screen. The outline on my talk is as follows. I'm going to look at, very briefly, why the Allies were in Italy to begin with, and point out that it is a rather unique campaign, because they both really didn't want to be there, and they both committed forces that they really wanted to send elsewhere. Then I'm going to look at the Cassino, why Cassino was so important, and then cover each of the four battles. And we need to be aware that New Zealanders tend to focus on the February-March battles, but there was actually a battle that preceded it in January, and there's one that ends it in May, and I will be talking about all four battles. And the way I plan to do that is look at what they planned to do, what they actually did, and the outcome. And then I'll wrap it up with some about four points I want to make about these various battles. So the first thing I want to talk about is why were they in Italy in the first place? Well, it was felt by the Allies, and particularly by Winston Churchill, that Italy was weak, particularly after losing its forces in North Africa, that they might be knocked out early in the war if Italy was invaded. There were easy pickings there, of course, that did happen. The other reason they wanted to be there, well, there were several, is that they were under pressure from the Soviet Union to open up a new front somewhere. The Soviet Union was continually reminding the Allies that they were doing the bulk of the fighting, particularly the land fighting, and they needed to do something to help win the war, particularly the land war. The resources were already there, particularly after the amphibious landing at Operation Torch. And if they captured Italy, that would provide some airfields which could reach the main source of oil for the Axis forces in Romania and the Ploiești oil fields. So Churchill was able to convince them, well, let's start with Sicily and see what happens. Sicily was taken relatively easily, and they decided to follow it up with the invasion of the Italian mainland in September 1943. But there is a huge difference between the vision that they had and the reality of it. And this is summed up, I think, in this slide here. Churchill, in his persuasive manner, was poring over maps and convinced himself and the Allies that this was Italy, was the soft underbelly of the crocodile. That was where they were going to be able to break into mainland Europe and defeat the Nazis. So what happened, and this is Mark Clark's version of it, instead of a soft underbelly, they actually found one tough old gun. And let me just tell you something about Mark Clark. Very, very vain man. You'll notice that in all the photographs that you have of him, he's insisting that he be photographed from this profile. For some reason, he thought the left side of his face was better than the right side. So every photograph he insists that gets taken from that angle. And as I mentioned before, the Italian campaign was unique in that both sides viewed it, in terms of military terms, as an economy of force operation, a subsidiary rather than a decisive theatre of war, where you could commit, hopefully, as few of your forces as possible and tie down as many as the Allies. So it's not a main theatre of war, it's a sideshow, and both sides are treated it that way. So why Cassino? Well, at the end of 1943, having narrowly avoided being driven into the sea at Salerno, the 5th Army captured the first big city, Naples, and they pushed further north of it. And they found themselves up against a big natural obstacle, more powerful than anything that they had yet tackled. And this was the Gustav Line running across the central Italy. And it is an immensely fortified defensive position. It consists of rows of fortress-like strong points with reinforced concrete, making natural use of heights and valleys and rivers. And all approaches to the Gustav Line are heavily mined and booby-trapped, strongly defended by German artillery, and well sighted and hidden from view. While it looks like a line on the map, that defensive position actually runs several kilometres deep. And you will notice that Monte Cassino is in the centre of the 5th Army position. And Monte Cassino becomes an important position to secure and take from the Allies. So this is a very good illustration from Time magazine in April, where it actually shows where the Germans are at the end result of the third battle. But there are several things that you need to know. I'll come around the side. This is the Abbey, Monte Cassino Abbey, which is going to cause quite a bit of pain. This is the town of Cassino, the Continental Hotel, which there's a lot of street fighting around it. This is the railway station, which is the scene where the Mario Battalion are decimated in the second battle, which I'm going to cover soon. You'll notice that this is a valley. These are the heights, offering immense observation over that position. Now, being at the 5th Army Centre, Monte Cassino dominates that part of the Gustav Line. The actual monastery is 518 metres high, or 1,700 feet, offering perfect observation. And you can see what it looks like from this photograph, which I grabbed from the New Zealand archives. The monastery on the hill, come around again. Monastery here, town of Monte Cassino at the base. It's empty by this stage, it's full of Germans and German troops defending, and also tanks and buildings and so forth. Here's the railway station. This is the embankment which the Mario Battalion are advancing along to capture the railway station. And this is one of the strongest defensive positions in the world at the time, and it's going to be assaulted by several frontal assaults, which become the various battles of Monte Cassino. So what do we have? We have the Luri Valley, the main route into Rome from the south. We have 6 months of attritional warfare and 4 separate battles, with the Allies attacking the strongest portion of the line. And I move now to look at the very first battle, which is largely an American and British affair. The first battle, and this is the view of the valley taken from Mount Trocchio. On the 15th of January 1944, the 5th Army managed to capture this high point called Mount Trocchio after a hard fight. It offered the perfect view into the valley below. But the 5th Army is exhausted and weak from its trial north to capture Mount Trocchio. It's advanced in 6 weeks, some 7 miles, so that's less than just over a mile a week, some 11 kilometres, and it's already suffered 16,000 casualties in making that short advance. But those tired, weak and hungry soldiers who were desperate for rest and reinforcements would receive neither, because just days after capturing Mount Trocchio, they were ordered to make a major assault against the Gustav Line, the strongest fortified position in the world. Why were they asked to attack when they were weak and needed rest? Why the haste? And the answer can be given in one word: Anzio. In order to draw the German soldiers and equipment away from Cassino and the Gustav Line, the Allies made a daring plan. They would land troops further north behind the Gustav Line and in an amphibious landing. Now, amphibious landings are very difficult to coordinate, very risky, but the Allies had now mounted two reasonably successfully, Operation Torch in North Africa and Operation Husky in Sicily. But this new amphibious landing would be different. First, it would be small. Only two divisions would be landed on the Anzio beach. Now, when I talk about divisions, I'm talking about some 18,000 men. They would move quickly, well, that was the plan, and they would capture the Auburn Hills, some 17 miles inland, and just 15 miles from Rome. There they would overlook two main highways, Highway 6 and Highway 7, which the Germans needed to supply their soldiers on the Gustav Line. The problem was that there were not enough landing craft in the Mediterranean area. They only had 68 available because the Allies were trying to build them up for Normandy landing, and they gave the forces in Italy just the month of January to have them. They needed them back at the end of January. So they planned the Anzio landing on the 22nd of January. The full plan for Anzio included the 5th Army making a series of attacks at Cassino to keep the German attention riveted there. There were 4 phases to this first Battle of Monte Cassino, and you can see them on this slide. Phase 1, the British 10th Corps would cross the river near the coast at Garigliano and turn inland to threaten the Liri Valley. Phase 2, the US 2nd Corps would force its way across the Rapido River and attack the Cassino. Phase 3, the French Expeditionary Force would push its way through the hills to the south of Cassino, hopefully threatening Cassino and an envelopment. And the 4th stage was 6 corps consisting of 2 divisions would land on the beach at Anzio. And Anzio was the key. In fact, phase 1, 3 and 4 went reasonably well. The British crossed the Garigliano River, captured some ground. The French continued their advance into the hills on the south side of Cassino. And however, none of them were able to fully threaten the Liri Valley. But phase 2 made an attack north of Cassino by the 36th US Division was an absolute disaster. If you look on this map here, hopefully you can see the Rapido River, which I get along here. It's in flood, and it's very deep, and it's also rapidly flowing, where it gets its name from. So overlooking, so the river was deep, with wide banks, and there were sunken lanes which the Germans could use. The river was deep and flowing, and it was also riveted with minefields. The 36th Division made 5 separate attacks to get across the Rapido and flank the Cassino town from the north. Unfortunately, it was an absolute disaster, and as one journalist said, this is the biggest disaster to American arms since Pearl Harbor. 1,681 casualties to take very little ground. And then there is the Cassino landing, okay? And it becomes very disappointing, as Churchill's famous quote about it. We hoped that we had sent a wild cat, on there to pull the Germans. Instead, we had a stranded whale. Unfortunately, somewhat true. The Anzio landing was very successful, it achieved complete surprise, but once getting the two divisions with some ranges ashore, the commander stopped and did not advance anywhere near the Auburn Hills, which were supposed to be his main objective. And I have to say, the Germans reacted very, very strongly. The Allies landed 36,000 men on the 22nd of January 1944. Within a day, the Germans had surrounded it by 70,000 troops, drawing divisions from all over the place. So I guess that's a really good economy of force operation, you know, two divisions against 70,000. But to sustain that bridgehead and to stop it from being driven into the sea, the Allies would eventually pump seven divisions and 150,000 men into the Anzio bridgehead just to hold it. The 5th Army tried one more attempt to take Casino using a different division, the 34th Division. It made three attempts to pierce the mountains, capture the town of Casino. They got within 400 yards or 365 metres, but could make no further progress. In fact, they were worn out. And as a New Zealand commander, Major General Howard Kippenberger, said of the American soldiers, and I have his quote on the screen there, "They had battled since January with stubbornness and gallantry beyond all praise, but they were absolutely worn out, and some of their battalions had suffered some 80% casualties." So the 5th Army is almost spent. So what then happens is that the 5th Army receives two new divisions from the 8th Army, the 4th Indian Division and the 2nd New Zealand Division. They are formed into a corps, the New Zealand Corps, and as the quote is here from Major General Al Gunter, that's Clark's Chief of Staff, "We're now throwing the torch to you. This is where we throw the torch to you. You are going to take over the battles at Casino." So the New Zealand Corps prepares for its first battle, which is confusingly the Second Battle of Casino. But before that happens, they request that the monastery on Monte Casino needs to be bombed. The first request for this came from the commander of the 4th Indian Division, Francis Tuka, who felt that his Indian and British soldiers needed it to be destroyed or at least badly damaged, so it couldn't be used as an observation post by the Germans. Now, the Germans had told the Allies they weren't using it, but they didn't trust the Germans, of course, and everybody thought that they were, and the soldiers on the ground thought that it was always watching them. Freyberg agreed that it should be destroyed, or at least badly damaged, and he passed the request up through the chain of command. Now, the senior general, Mark Clark, photographed in his favourite profile there, I have to say, decided he was against it. He felt that it didn't need to be destroyed, and there had been a directive issued at the beginning of 1944 to try not to damage historic buildings. But he was overruled, Alexander agreed, and the American Air Force planned to destroy Monte Cassino in an overwhelming attack. In fact, one senior American commander promised Freyberg, "If you let me use our whole bombing force, we'll whip it out like a dead tooth," is what he told him. And that is pretty much what they did. Now, Freyberg had made an original request for 36 medium bombers to soften up the monastery prior to an infantry attack. He got much more than this. First to arrive were 135 B-17 Flying Fortresses, and within the space of half an hour, they dropped 257 tonnes of high explosives and 59 tonnes of incendiary bombs on the monastery. Have to say, most of them missed, okay, but they did make some hits. Then later in that morning, 87 medium bombers dropped a further 283 1,000-pound bombs. While most of those missed, some of them had been successful, and the monastery was finished off by British artillery. As one artillery officer said, the targets being cabbaged real good. Sad to say, I have to say, most soldiers at Casino clapped and cheered as the bombs fell, and they were only too pleased to see a building that they hated destroyed. Only a few were sick at heart. Unfortunately, this bombing is a major tactical mistake. Why? Because the 4th Indian Division were told it was happening and they were not ready to make an attack. In fact, they would not be ready for 3 days, and when they launched their attack on the 18th of February, it was easily driven off. And the bombing of this monastery actually favoured the Germans, because if they weren't there beforehand, they were afterwards, and they turned it into a magnificent defensive position. The large piles of rubble and the tunnels could be buried underneath made excellent defensive positions, and Mark Clark is quite right when he says it was a major tactical mistake of first magnitude. It made the job more difficult and more costly in terms of men and machines. Monastery's been bombed. The New Zealanders and the 4th Indian Division are ready to make their attack, and they do so between the 15th and 18th of February 1944. The 4th Indian Division, using 3 battalions, would sweep across the slopes and launch a direct attack on the monastery. And while that was happening, the 28th Maori Battalion would advance from Mount Trocchio along the railway embankment and capture the Casino Railway Station. And this is what is planned. An attack on the heights by the 4th Indian Division, an attack against the railway station going along the embankment to capture the railway station, using 1 battalion, the 28th Maori Battalion. Now, the success of the operation for the Maori soldiers depended on the New Zealand engineers who would follow them. These sappers had to repair all the demolitions that the Germans had made along the embankment so that Bailey bridges could be built across 2 water obstacles, and that air tanks, anti-tank guns and vital supplies could reach those at the railway station. The Indians had a very hard job fighting uphill, and they basically failed. They reached within 400 yards, some 4 football fields away, but they could not get any closer. Meanwhile, below them, the Maori soldiers advanced along the railway embankment, and they too came up against mortar and machine gun fire. They had to cross a minefield and belts of barbed wire, but they did it. And by midnight, the Maori soldiers had captured the railway station and many German prisoners. Success now depended on the New Zealand engineers and how fast they could work at night. Now, the engineers worked frantically. They had a lot of jobs to do that night. They had to clear the minefields, the booby traps and all barbed wire. They had to fill in all the craters that had been caused by German demolition experts. And they had to build 2 Bailey bridges, one over a canal and 1 over a river, all done under machine gun and mortar fire. And they almost did it. At dawn, they had nearly finished their work, except for 1 large demolition crater, which they hadn't been able to fill, and they couldn't work during daylight because they were exposed to overwhelming machine gun fire. Pretty good effort, though, to build 2 Bailey bridges, I would think, in one night, Joe. I think that's got to be something of a record. For infantry soldiers who have captured enemy positions, tank support and anti-tank weapons are vital to their survival. The Maori soldiers at the railway station had none of that support, and they were asked to hold on to the railway station until nightfall, when that 1 demolition could be repaired. And meanwhile, the New Zealand artillery would try and protect them. The Maori soldiers at the railway station were in a terrible position. They'd already suffered over 100 casualties in their night attack, and if they held on, they might just be able to win this battle. And to protect them, the New Zealand gunners fired a smoke screen for most of that day. But it was a double-edged sword, because just after 3 p.m, German tanks and infantry advanced through the smoke screen and attacked the railway station from both sides. There was a short, deadly fight. Some Maori soldiers were killed, quite a few were captured, but most withdrew back to the New Zealand position. This was the 2nd Battle of Casino, and the Allies had lost again. The weather and the terrain had certainly played a role, but so had poor Allied decisions. It was a mistake to bomb the monastery when the Indian Division was not ready to attack. It was a mistake to rely solely on a smoke screen to protect the Maori soldiers at the railway station, especially when the Allies had total command of the air. It was also a mistake to use 1 battalion. And the Germans showed yet again what excellent fighters they were in defensive positions. If that one demolition could have been repaired in time, this battle may have had a different outcome. Luck plays a part in war, and the luck was not on the Allies' side in the Second Battle of Cassino. I now move on to the third battle, where both the Indian Division and the 2nd New Zealand Division will play a key part. This time, the plan involved destruction of the town by the overwhelming use of aerial bombing and artillery. This use of overwhelming firepower was supposed to make the job of the soldiers on the ground that much easier. Cassino could not be outflanked because it meant crossing the Rapido. So a direct attack on the town and Monastery Hill was planned, and this is the plan on this slide here. The 4th Indian Division and the 2nd New Zealand Division will work side by side and advance down three separate roads. The New Zealanders were allocated the town as their objective, and the Indians once again Monastery Hill. There was a 3rd Division from 8th Army, the 78th, held in reserve. While this attack was similar to the first two battles, the Allies believed that their ace card was air power. The infantry attack would be preceded by a bombing that had never been done in this theatre of war before. Cassino Town, which was basically a fortified town consisting only of enemy soldiers, would be turned into dust. Those Germans sheltering in the town were all to be killed by the bombing. Prior to the Indian and New Zealand soldiers advancing, Cassino would be bombed for 4 hours by everything the Allies had in the air. Once the 4 hours were over, then 900 guns, artillery pieces would add to that destruction. Nothing, it would believe, could survive that onslaught, or so the Allies believed. And there is a photograph of Cassino Town being bombed to some Marines. Preparations had been made as early as 22nd of February, but it was delayed by bad weather until the 15th of March. And on that fine, clear morning, 514 planes dropped their bombs on Cassino Town and Monastery Hill, the largest air operation in Italy to date. 1,100 tonnes of high explosive bombs fell on Cassino. That's 100 tonnes of HE for every square mile of town. And it was devastating. When the bombs stopped falling, the artillery opened up just after noon, 900 guns, and they fired over 200,000 rounds of artillery, adding another 1,200 tonnes of high explosives. But here's something that didn't get a lot of publicity at the time. Not all the bombs fell on Monastery Hill, and nearly half of those that did missed their targets. In fact, not all bombs fell on Cassino either, and a lot of the bombs missed their target. In fact, some didn't even recognise the target. And the poor little town of Anafro was particularly unfortunate. It was more than 10 miles away from Cassino, 16 kilometres away, but it was bombed 3 times by the Allied Air Force on 3 separate occasions. Now, those soldiers close to the front line, watching where the bombing was, were also in danger, and several senior officers had narrow escapes. Now, the commander of 8th Army, who actually wasn't involved in this battle, came forward to watch it. His name is General Oliver Leese, the 8th Army commander. He watched the bombing. He returned to his headquarters and found his headquarters had been destroyed completely. He said to his staff officers, "I see our American friends have been here." And then he rang up the 5th Army Commander Mark Clark and he said to him, "Have I done anything to upset you lately?" But it is a tragedy because 96 soldiers and 140 Italian civilians were killed in this bombing. Were injured, and 17 soldiers and 14 civilians were killed. But despite that inaccuracy, enough bombs had fallen on the town that it had turned it into rubble. It was destroyed, and I'll just go back one. This is what General Alexander, watching it, said. Nothing could be left alive in that town. The Germans had certainly suffered heavily, and more than half of those in Cassino had been killed. As one German soldier said, and I'm quoting from his diary, "It was like the end of the world.
comrades were wounded, buried alive, dug out again, eventually buried for the second time. Whole platoons and squads were obliterated by direct hits. We all wanted to escape this living hell. While they wanted to escape it, they did not run away. And the survivors actually linked arms with each other, held their hands over their ears to stop their eardrums from being ruptured. And when the bombing stopped, they were ready to fight. But believing that everyone in the town was dead or incapacitated, the New Zealanders sent only small numbers of troops to capture the town. The tanks that were meant to escort them could not go into the town because of the craters and piles of rubbish. Now, the New Zealanders who watched the attack were shocked and staggered when the Germans emerged from the rubble and started fighting. They were basically beaten off. And the Indian division on Monastery Hill managed to capture a small feature called Hangman's Hill, but they did not capture the monastery. And over the next 2 weeks, despite more bombing, more artillery barrages and repeated infantry attacks, the Germans held the western part of Casino Town and they still held Monastery Hill. Nothing could shift them despite the grim, tough fighting on both sides. And you can see some of the progress on this map. The Germans are holding the narrow western belt of the town of Casino, but they are still holding the monastery above it. On the 22nd of March, the New Zealand Division made one last attempt to capture Casino. When it failed, Alexander ordered the battle to cease. And General Freyberg, who visited the troops on the 23rd of March, the day after, concluded the New Zealand Division, I'm quoting from his diary, had come to the end of its tether. Then he again wrote that the New Zealand soldiers in Casino, I'm quoting from his diary again, were in the worst military position that he had ever seen troops in. The Third Battle of Monte Casino cost the Allies more than 2,000 casualties. Losses in the Indian Division totaled just over 1,000, with 132 killed. New Zealand casualties for the 7 weeks that the New Zealand Corps was around Casino amounted to nearly 1,400, with 206 being killed in action and a further 101 missing. And I give you Ian McGibbon's assessment of what this meant for the New Zealanders. This is a costly failure which ranks alongside Passchendaele, that worst ever military disaster, in terms of what it means for New Zealand. Both Allied and German soldiers agreed that it was the quality of the German soldiers defending the town that won this battle. The German commander at Casino later stated to a superior officer, I'm quoting from what he said in telephone conversation, no troops but the 1st Parachute Division could have held Casino. And General Alexander, the overall commander, told Kippenberger some weeks later, and I'm quoting from what he told him, if you had not been faced by the best division in the German army, you would have succeeded. But the third battle for Casino was a clear victory yet again for the German defenders. The Allies lost this battle for three main reasons. First, it's the quality of the German defenders. The plan was also poor. A frontal assault on well-defended positions really succeeded, as had been shown in the previous two battles. And third, the ground attack, when it was made, lacked force, speed and aggression. The New Zealand Corps commander had relied too much on air and fire power to win this battle. What it needed was more infantry power and perhaps engineering power as well. And now turn to the fourth and final battle. Now, General Alexander was absolutely sick of losing at Casino and he took direct command of the battle and regrouped his forces. And this is a picture of Alexander, very much the aristocrat, fine military commander, but not a great planner. In fact, some people thought he was a little bit thick, but never mind. But great character and a lot of charisma. But what happened was he wanted to group his forces where he would attack in one place and actually concentrate some force. And he quoted from Nelson that only numbers can annihilate it. And he actually asked Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff, for some help. And Brooke sent him one of the best military commanders, both combat and staff officer, to help him. And it's this guy in the jeep with him, one General A.F. Harding. And this is the new planner, known as John Harding, one of the unsung heroes of the Second World War, I think. And Harding, who was a reputation of a great planner, been recommended by Montgomery, sent out by Brooke, he looked at the previous plans for the battle and he came up with one of his own. He felt that the other plans had ignored a fundamental principle of command: concentration of force against the enemy's weakest point. He devised a plan that not only intended to capture vital ground like Casino Town, the monastery, and perhaps Rome, but one that would destroy the German Allied forces in Italy. And it was codenamed Operation Diadem, which actually means crown. There were some critical differences between the fourth battle and the other three. Oops, sorry about that. First, it was not rushed. Alexander could take his time about when and where to strike. Second, overwhelming force would be applied. Third, it would be made in spring weather. And fourth, they would use deception for the first time. It was intended to trick the Germans that there was going to be another amphibious landing made by three divisions north of Rome. To do this, they made fake signs, they directed false radio traffic, they had military exercises, which looked like they were amphibious military exercises, all aimed to fool the Germans that the attack, a new amphibious landing was going to be made somewhere north of Rome. That wasn't planned, but the Germans believed it, and they kept the bulk of their reserve troops to the north to counter this landing. While this was happening, Alexander secretly moved most of the 8th Army to the Liri Valley and brought it alongside the American 5th Army there. And this is the plan that they came up with. For the numbers of tanks and planes, the plan was a simple one. On the right, we have the 8th Army, consisting of the Polish Corps, whose job was to take the Casino feature, and the 13th British Corps on its left, which was to advance along the road to Rome. On the left of the 8th Army was the 5th Army, which would advance along the main coastal road that formed the left wall of the Liri Valley. That would be the US 2nd Corps doing that. They're the ones on the towards the bottom of the slide. While the French Corps, who were experienced at mountain fighting, would advance through the mountains. This is a massive concentration of force. You're talking about over 2,000 tanks, 1,600 guns, 3,000 aircraft, all deployed along a 20-mile front. Now that's the equivalent of 45 guns, 57 tanks and 85 aircraft for every 1,000 yards. And it would involve infantry soldiers from 9 divisions, all attacking at once. Now, prior to Operation Diadem, the Air Force launched Operation Strangle, which was aimed, as it said, to strangle the Germans of any supplies that they might have. It aimed to harass the Germans as much as possible, targeting railways, bridges, roads, ports. Started on the 19th of March and continued until the 5th of June, the day Rome was taken. It was a massive effort, 120,000 sorties flowing, and the air commanders thought if they did enough, the Germans would be able to give up the Gustav Line. They didn't do that, but at the start of Operation Diadem, the Germans were only receiving about half of what they needed each day. 11 p.m., 11th of May, Operation Diadem is launched. 1,600 guns opening in unison. For 45 minutes, they fired on every 9 German position, and behind those flickering skylines, the infantry waited. The word came to advance, and across a 20-mile front, the infantry from 2 armies, many different nations, advanced towards an uncertain fate. Now, all along the line, despite all that firepower, the Germans still put up strong resistance. This is especially true for the Polish Corps, whose commander was obsessed with the Poles capturing the ruins of Monte Cassino. While the Poles were held up, the Americans on the left struggled to take their objectives. It was the French Corps in the centre that was the most successful. Not only did he take all his objectives, but he pushed forward his reserves to exploit the success. This is where the difference is made. This is the French Corps, consisting of 4 divisions, mostly African troops, I have to say.
This is the 1st French Motorised Division, this is the 2nd Moroccan Division, this is the Algerian Division, and this is another division made up of African troops, and they are the ones that punch through this mountain line here, through the second line of defence, and almost reach Highway 6. They're the ones that made most progress in this attack. But just on the left side of Casino, the 8th Indian Division and the 4th British Division took their objectives and exploited bridgeheads over the river. German counterattacks failed and Casino was being slowly encircled. The battle continued over the next 2 days with both German and Allied casualties mounting. But the 8th Indian and 4th British Division had crossed the Rapido and expanded the bridgehead and managed to meet the main road. But it was the French Expeditionary Corps that made outstanding progress, capturing mountain peaks and pushing further north. On the 14th of May, the 4th British and 8th Indian Division managed to complete the encirclement of Casino. And the Poles decided to carry out another attack, which was repulsed. They decided to make an attack on the 18th of May, and they found the monastery had been empty. Rather than risking encirclement and capture, the last of the German defenders withdrew. Some Germans were there, but they were too sick or wounded to walk, and they'd be left behind. It was the outflanking movements that had forced the Germans to finally leave the monastery, and many men had been killed or wounded to take it. The Poles alone lost nearly 4,000 casualties, which was half their force that they employed. Now, part of Harding's plan had been for a breakout from the Anzio beachhead. And what the plan involved was there were now 7 divisions in the Anzio beachhead, 150,000 men, and they were to attack in this direction here, to reach this town of Narmontone, and they were to cut this road, that is Highway 6, the main German way to withdraw. And if this commander, his 10th Army, had followed that plan, the entire German 10th Army, which is fighting in South Casino, would have been trapped. But what happened was that Mark Clark, being a very vain man, wanted to have the honour and glory of capturing Rome, you know, the first capital city. So when they were within half a mile of Valmontone and cutting that road, he directed the commander, he ordered the commander here, which was a very good fighting commander, Lucy Trusco, to instead of attacking that way, to attack to the northwest and concentrate on attacking Rome, which they did. And of course the German 10th Army escaped and lived to fight another day. Very disappointing for Alexander, very disappointing for Harding, because if they'd done that, the war in Italy may have been over. I have to say, this is one of the main controversies around Mark Clark and the battle of and the fighting in Italy. That's the 4 battles. Now, there are 4 points I want to make, and then I'll close and take any questions. The first thing to know is that these battles are international affairs. There are some 26 different nationalities fighting the Germans here. Among the Allied soldiers and airmen include men and women from Poland, France, India, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Brazil, the United States, United Kingdom, and so many more. 26 separate nationalities. As this historian John North has written, we're unlikely to see such an array take to the field under one command ever again. This first point, this is an international affair. Second, the battles witnessed some of the most savage fighting ever seen in the Second World War, among the most dreadful conditions. And even Adolf Hitler acknowledged this. Hitler once remarked that these battles were the only ones of this war like those on the Western Front of the First World War. The third point I would make is that it is generally acknowledged that the Allied military leadership was really poor during these battles. And one of the harshest critics is John Ellis, who wrote a fine book on Casino, and you get its theme from its subtitle, The Hollow Victory. And he is absolutely scathing of the quality of Allied military leadership, particularly in the first 3 battles of Casino. And he says
The third battle of Casino, which involves obviously Indians and New Zealanders, was where Allied leadership during the war was at its lowest point. And even some senior commanders, like this guy, the most senior American commander in theatre at the time, knew that they had failed at Monte Cassino, and Jacob Devers thought it was because they actually hadn't formed a team. Now, regarding the New Zealand Corps, I have to say this was not Freiburg's finest hour, and quite a few New Zealand historians have tried to gloss over Freiburg's performance at Cassino, but international historians have been scathing. And Major General Sir Howard Kippenberger, I wrote something on, actually knew the truth, and he says this. Kippenberger later wrote, it's in the archives where many people find it, that Freiburg was actually lost at Cassino and that it was his worst performance of the war, and Kippenberger thought that Freiburg knew that himself. Now, Freiburg's certainly not at his best. He's weighed down with political considerations as the commander of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force and military considerations as commander of the New Zealand Corps. That was a role that had been split during the First World War, and in my view, it should have been split during this one. It just overloads Freiburg with too much work. He was also exhausted after 4 years of war as the GIC on both New Zealand Division and New Zealand Expeditionary Force. To make matters worse, having convinced Kippenberger, his most talented subordinate, to stay on and serve, Kippenberger was seriously wounded on the 2nd of March while making a reconnaissance on Mount Trocchio. Added to these burdens, Freiburg was also deeply worried about his only son, who was reported missing at Anzio. And I've given you a comment of a senior New Zealand brigadier, Bill Stevens, who recalled just how low Freiburg's spirits had reached during this battle. The only occasion where his normal optimism and confidence had deserted him. And the last point I would make is that it's a tragic reality that when commanders have bad days, like probably bad times, men will die. The casualties in all the Cassino battles were high, over 100,000 Allied casualties, and at least 80,000 German soldiers became casualties in these four hellish battles of Monte Cassino. This is the Polish memorial at Monte Cassino, very moving with that statement engraved on it. But there is also another cemetery which is rarely visited, and it's the German cemetery at a little village called Caro. And it is the largest military cemetery in Italy, where more than 24,000 German soldiers are buried. They are buried three to a grave, and some of them have these words repeated three times, ein deutscher Soldat, which means a German soldier. They don't know who he is, and you know, so the unknown warrior. 24,000 German soldiers buried here. The battle and what those men went through should never be forgotten, and it's really heartening to see so many people here this afternoon. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
New Zealand Division was not in the fourth battle. It had been absolutely exhausted by its fighting in the third. It had been withdrawn to rest and reconstitute. There were some observers used, but no actual fighting forces. That is a really good question. Not only did they have superiority in the air, they actually had air supremacy, which meant they dominated the skies. A lot of reasons why they weren't able to use it so much was because of the bad weather, and they're actually fighting in the winter, which makes it really, really hard. But I have to say, in my book on Cassino, I have two chapters devoted to the air war and why they weren't used enough and why there was no use of close air support. Particularly on the 15th of February for the Maoris at the railway station, you know, lying on a smokescreen doesn't make much sense, really, when you're dominating the skies. And the day was quite clear that day, too, so, you know, why they couldn't have been used, I don't know. I know why. They hadn't practiced close air support, and there was no air observer with the Maori battalion at the railway station. But for the fact that they dominated the skies, the argument is they didn't do an awful lot. Now, Operation Strangle, where they did pull all their resources, the official American Army historian said, oh, it didn't make much effect at all. But the Air Force history says, well, you don't look at the fact that they didn't leave the Gustav line, you look at how many supplies were getting through. And the Germans were really low on supplies for the attack of Dydam. In fact, they're getting less than 50% of what they needed. So they were being used, but they weren't being used in ways that would be very effective for the ground forces. And close air support was virtually non-existent in these four battles of Monte Cassino. Sad fact. Better at Anzio, where Lucien Truscott actually demanded some close air support, much better there, but in the four battles of Cassino, it wasn't much use. Yes. Sorry, Joe, you control the questions?
So, at the level of high command,
yeah,
how much clout did Freiburg and Kuppenberger really have?
At the level of high command, not a lot. Particularly covering here is the tactical level. They had a lot of clout, but Freiburg seemed to be lost as to how to deal with the casino town and the monastery. So much so that Kippenberger at one stage threatens to resign, particularly after the second battle, when he's told to prepare the third one. And he said, "There's nothing new in it. We're going to repeat what we've done before." And as I say, he actually threatened to resign unless it was changed. But then he got wounded. Now the argument is, was that deliberate or accidental? I'm not really sure. Well, here's a trained major general who strays from a tape through a minefield and strays away from the tapes marking the clear line. Why did he do that? I'm not sure. But yeah, he had probably had a lot of ability at the tactical level, and he could have actually changed things, but not at the higher level, the strategic level.
Yes, as in Vietnam,
do
you think casino illustrate the limitation of air power?
Yes, I do. When I was putting that book together on Monte Cassino, I couldn't believe how inaccurate the bombers were on. Bombing the monastery and bombing the casino town. Mistaking a town 10 miles away from casino. I mean, how does that happen? I think the notion of precision bombing in the Second World War is a misnomer. I don't think they're able to do it.
There's no such thing. My father was at Cassino, and talking to him some years ago, he said most of those American bombers, their map reading was absolutely shocking. Anyway, at the altitude that they dropped the bombs and carpet bombing, they went everywhere. So they followed Highway 6 up the Leary Valley and just opened the bomb doors and let it go. I mean, how many aircraft in those waves initially? I think you said that.
Well, the first wave over 500.
500 of them. You can imagine. He said the sky was absolutely thick of them at a very high level.
The Italians used to say when the German Air Force came over, the British would run away, but when the American Air Force came over, everybody ran away.
What altitude did they come over at?
Some of it was quite low.
My understanding is that they were pretty low.
You think a town that's near a river at the base of a monastery would be quite easy to see, and navigate, but,
maybe it was windy.
Well, if you actually have a look at it on the ground, bomb runs coming in from the south, up Highway 6, to try and get their bombs either into the town or onto the monastery, is actually quite a feat because of the topography. And if any of you have been there and stood, on the embankment, on the railway embankment, adjacent to where the Commonwealth War Graves Cemetery is now, just down the road from their new Science and Technology University, Casino Science and Technology University, if you stand there and have a look directly up at the railway station, it's almost as if the bombers had to come in and throw them both at the railway station at the town, or throw them on top of the monastery because of the topography.
Yeah. The B-17s came in at 18,000 feet. The lighter bombers, medium bombers, came in about 10,000 feet. The Boston, the Liberators, etc.
So it's still a fair way up as well. So you can imagine, spread.
If you've got 500 aircraft coming in, they cover a hell of an area.
That's right.
Yeah, they're not as though they're following.
And they're not wing to wing to be.
No.
Yeah.
And my father's diary was on very in remember that day because it was his birthday.
So, what was the role and the effectiveness of intelligence in determining what the enemy forces' locations and strengths were? And did it have any influence on any of the battles?
It's a good question. Intelligence on the Allied side was much better, mainly through ultra intercepts, and they were being fed to the commanders in Italy. The intelligence on the German side was pretty woeful, I have to say, but it didn't seem to make much effect to their fighting ability. For example, the landing at Anzio was not picked up by German intelligence at all, and in fact they'd sent a message to Kesselring saying, indications are nothing's happening, you can basically relax for the next couple of weeks. And that was on the 20th of January, and the Anzio landing happened on the 22nd, so they had not picked that up. The British intelligence was much better because of their radio intercept capability and the ultra cycle of Bletchley Park and all that. But being able to use the intelligence wisely was not something that they seemed to be particularly good at, particularly Fifth Army.
And I guess the counter to that was senior commanders didn't want to let on that they had the information, otherwise the enemy would have found out that there was either a leak somewhere or they were clamped down on their communications and their use of ultra or whatever. But that's another consideration. Yeah.
Didn't the Allies rebuild Monte Cassino afterwards?
Yeah, Monte Cassino Abbey was rebuilt, absolutely, but it had been destroyed three times before. It's not the original building.
I understand that.
It had been destroyed by an invasion in about almost 200 years after it was built. It was destroyed in an earthquake and rebuilt. And it has a motto which means brought down but rebuilt again. I can't remember the Latin for it, but it's happened. It's the fourth time it's been damaged.
And it's not an insignificant building.
No. Oh, it's a big chunk of stone.
Yeah, it is huge. Yes, Jim.
Yeah. If it was the strongest part of the German line, why did they choose to attack there rather?
That's the question that historians have asked themselves. It is. It's absolutely the strongest part in the line. Why do you do that? You know, and why haven't you thought about using deception until the fourth battle, which is where it worked really, really well? Why not try and attack somewhere else? The Eighth Army had attacked on Osona and Ortona, and the Canadians actually pierced the Gustav line at one stage, but they basically stopped. You know, decided that was enough. I can't answer that question. Why attack at the strongest part three times? You know, the repeat of what's happening before, and in such small forces. You know, John Ellis is right. You're attacking with single divisions, and for the second battle, the battle that Freiburg faced, one battalion on the ground and three battalions on the top. It just doesn't make any sense, you know, attacking the strongest defensive position with, you know, little driblets of force like that.
And during winter.
Yeah.
And while the ground was flooded.
Yep.
I mean, the ground either side of the railway embankment, which was the actual, you know, sort of highest part of the ground there, everything else was flooded. Mm. And, of course, the railway embankment on either side of the railway was mined. I mean, trying to get forces up at an axis of advance, you know, while one tank at frontage is ridiculous. Absolutely. Anyway, any other questions? I think we've probably just exhausted the questions, but what I thought might be a good idea is, Mark, do you want to just make some comments of some items that you've thought that people might be interested in having a look at?
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Mark Arnett, one of your city councillors. I talked to Mayor Grant a couple of times today. He sends his apologies and his very best wishes to each and every one of you. He was on breakfast this morning, as Joe said, and unfortunately the city's plagued at the moment by vandalism, and being on the PNDHAG, the Palmerston North Defence Surge Advisory Group, I've counted many times sanitised being vandalised since I've been in council for the last year and a half. He started calling me his court councillor because I've got pretty strong views, and but those views got me elected in the first place, so I don't apologise at all. I had an Uncle Brian over there who served the casino, and he used to tell me lots of stories. He had a big loud boomy voice because he was half deaf, He was a Lance Bombardier. He went over as a sergeant and came back as a Lance Bombardier. as lots of our soldiers did, they got up to a bit of no good, and that German gas master canister came back filled with money from petrol he sold to the Italians. And he used to tell me that his first flock of sheep, as a farmer, was bought with the money that he got overseas. In that canister was also a pearl-handled Luger, which he picked up at a casino town. And when the troop ship came into Wellington, the word came around that everybody was going to be searched. And so the amount of small arms that must be on the Wellington seafloor would be phenomenal. Anyway, nobody got searched. He was very sore about that for the rest of his life. My interest in all things military started as a five-year-old sitting on the back doorstep with my grandfather in Rangatira, who was a builder. And that day I was helping him shine his shoes, and as you can see, that sort of rubbed off on me. And he, that day, in his container was a container of buttons, and he gave me this button that day and tied a piece of string on it so I didn't lose it. It's the same button, it's had a few bits of string over the years. Brian had a sheep farm in Taitahuna down the Longburn Strait opposite the Rocket, and driving past there last few days, having a bit to do with the Opiki Bridge, how it was restrung, the amount of skid marks there and the antisocial behaviour. If Brian was still alive, that wouldn't be there, because I'm sure he would have been out there with one of his shotguns. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. I'm sure many of you had fathers, uncles, whatever, involved, particularly during World War II, and would be of similar thought. Look, just I want to pass on particular thanks to Glyn for another excellent presentation. Please put your hands together and thank Glyn once again. Oh, yeah, sorry.